This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of September the 21st, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you by Nichols Patrick, CP Incorporated, and your State Society of CPAs. We're going to take a look at what's gone on this week. And again, like last week, we've had a lot of things happen. It seems like the IRS and the courts, Congress, well, not Congress quite yet, are trying to catch up with what they missed when August came by. Remember, in August, we had a number of weeks with not much happening. Now, suddenly, lots of things start happening. And let's start out here with a revenue procedure to, speaking of Congress, deal with a problem Congress has given us. We're going to look here at Revenue Procedure 2015-48. This revenue procedure was issued on the 15th of September. This revenue procedure deals with a little problem we've got. Congress, as you're probably aware, has let bonus depreciation and certain other provisions expire from the law on multiple occasions. Congress then comes back nearly 12 months after the expiration and restores the item to the law. Well, for calendar year taxpayers, that's been fine. So we suddenly discover we have bonus depreciation in late December. That means at least when we prepare the returns for the prior year, we know we're going to be using bonus depreciation. As you're aware, you must use bonus depreciation unless you elect out based on the law, and Congress always restores all law to say the same thing. So while we can't plan for bonus depreciation, we can at least prepare the tax returns. Fiscal year taxpayers, though, face another problem. They have been having to prepare returns under the assumption that bonus depreciation did not exist for any asset placed in service after the beginning of 2015. Last year, they had to make that assumption for any asset placed in service after the beginning of 2014. What's the problem? Well, let's talk about a January 31st fiscal year corporation. That corporation's tax return is due on April the 15th. Well, they can go for an extension. That's all well and good, but the extension only gets them to October 15th. By October 15th of 2014, Congress had still not extended the provision. So let us assume that that particular taxpayer had purchased a number of assets in January of 2014. Well, there they didn't use bonus depreciation. Now Congress comes back, retroactively changes the law, and effectively their tax return is retroactively wrong. Revenue Procedure 2015-48 deals with how to handle that situation. And generally they go back to those of us who remember the original bonus depreciation enactment in 2012, where they enacted it in March and it affected the prior year. IRS goes back to the same routine. Generally, you are allowed to file a return if you wish to make use of the bonus. You can also have a presumed election. If you elect it out, you're allowed to undo that election out because conceivably you might have elected out of bonus depreciation because you only acquired one asset before, one new asset. Remember, only new assets qualify for this before the end of December, but now suddenly there's a whole bunch of assets you no longer want to elect out. You can now undo that election or you can make an election, all of which can be done with either an amended return or a Form 3115. They'll allow you to do it either way. This also deals with the rule that we have. Remember that we have the Section 179 for real property, where if we have carryover in the final year, we have to go back and set up on the depreciation schedule and then treat it as depreciated. Well, of course, that creates problems because that provision keeps expiring, and that does even affect calendar year returns. We have rules in here to deal with that. So basically, we can deal with both. If you have a client affected by either one of these, you want to go take a look at this revenue procedure. Next up is a proposed regulation, Regulation 138-344-13, which was issued on the 17th of September. This is a proposed but not yet effective regulation that would allow a charity to file a report that would count as contemporary written acknowledgement for the donor. The charity would have to file that information return with the IRS by February the 28th and provide a copy to the donor. Now, this is probably being done not because I expect many charities to do it. By the way, by the rules, if the IRS adopts this, anything filed, you can't file this return late. So if the charity doesn't get it filed by February 28th, it doesn't count. Your client still needs to have contemporaneous written acknowledgement before the return is filed. That's the rule we're working under now. Secondly, it seems to me there's a little incentive for a charity to do this because since they have to mail out this acknowledgement and this form will contain everything in the contemporaneous acknowledgement, well, why don't they just mail that out to the taxpayer and not bother with filing anything with the IRS. Well, unless donors start complaining for it, wouldn't happen. Finally, don't forget, this is not yet the rule. The question becomes, why is the IRS allowing this? Well, the key was the code said the IRS could come up with procedures to allow charities to do this. But that went into the law many, many years ago when this first came into law back in the 90s. IRS has never done anything about it. The IRS has kind of ignored it. Now suddenly the IRS is saying, well, maybe we should do something about it. Why? I think the IRS has a concern. They have been auditing a number of returns, and they have had a number of court case wins, like in the Durden case, where the IRS prevailed because the documentation did not contain all necessary information. The Durden case is especially, shall we say, an unfair result, as the tax court mentioned, because there it was clear the person had made a five-figure contribution to a church. The church had said, you made a five-figure contribution. However, the document he had when the audit began never said he didn't receive anything. He got a letter from the church saying he didn't receive anything. But remember, the rule is you have to have that before filing a return, so the tax court had to disallow the entire amount. Some taxpayers have, in response to that, tried to claim that, well, wait, there's this thing that charities could file a statement, and the IRS has never provided the procedures. So what we're going to ask a charity to do, if they're okay with doing it, is to amend their 990 and list the contribution on the 990. Then that's a form filed with the IRS that would serve as a contemporaneous acknowledgement. The service claims that doesn't work, but I think the service is a bit concerned, and we'll discuss this in a little bit later in chief counsel advice on a different issue, that a court might try to reach in there and use that to get rid of an unfair result like in Durden. Therefore, it appears to me the IRS is proposing this reg primarily to try to shut down any option, because it does say effectively you must do it this way. It must be done by February 28th. Therefore, what that really means is on exam, you couldn't get it. Remember, you can get your contemporaneous written acknowledgement all the way through the date you file your return. But this particular document would have to come out by February 28th. Next up, if you use with the IRS special per diem rates, they issued the new ones now because we're heading to October 1st. Notice 2015-63 provides the new rates for the periods from October 1st of 2015 to September 30th of 16. Now, these are the rates other than the normal ones you find on the GSA website that tell us what the rates are for specific localities. Some businesses, the IRS member tried to pull this away a couple years ago saying they don't see why anybody would use it. Well, it turns out a lot of people did. So the IRS went back and said, okay, we're going to allow this. So the special high-low rates are still in there. And the high-low rate method this year changes to amounts that we have at this point. The high-low rate is $275 if it's a high-cost area, and $68 of that will be deemed to be for meals. So if you're doing a meals reimbursement only, you do the $68, that's meals and incidentals. And it's $185 for any locality not in the high-cost area, $57 per meals. Of that total, incidentals are $5. So if you're both having the employee account for, or you're paying for meals directly and hotel directly, but you're not paying for incidentals, then $5 is the incidental reimbursement that can be done. The notice also contains a list of the high-cost localities and has a summary in it of the changes, that is, which localities went onto the list, which localities came off the list, effective on October 1st. It also has the special per diem rates for trucking. That will be $63 for in the continental United States, and $68 for outside the continental United States. Now let's get back to that question about the IRS never implementing regulations on something. This particular ruling in this case deals with a lack of regulations in an odd area. This is Chief Counsel Memorandum 2015-37-021. This was issued on September the 11th of 2015. Now there's a provision in the code under Section 1359 that allows for deferral of gain on dispositions of, in certain cases, what's called qualifying vessels. And there's a time frame where they have to be replaced. And we're not going to worry about the details of this provision too much because for most of you, it's not relevant. For those of you who it is relevant, you probably know all about this. However, there is a provision in there that says if you don't, you either have to do it within 2 years, or if you file for and get permission from the IRS, you're allowed to do a longer period of time. So this says, subject to such terms and conditions as may be specified by the secretary, that is the IRS, the taxpayer may get assigned a later date than 2 years. Now, this was part of the 2004 tax bill, but regulations have never been issued to explain how to do this. Now we have a taxpayer who's not been able to replace the qualifying vessel within 2 years. Now they're writing to the IRS and asking for this extended date permission. The question being posed to the chief counsel's office is, does the IRS have to actually rule on this request? In essence, since we've issued no regulations and told nobody how to do this, can we just ignore it? The chief counsel's office looks at the detail of this and came to the conclusion that, in fact, in this particular case, where the only thing the IRS had to do was to describe methods of doing it, they said you're allowed to do it. They merely gave the IRS permission to prescribe methods, that the IRS, by not having issued those regs, can't stop taxpayers from making use of the provision. The ruling goes on to note it's different if when a rule says that the secretary, to the extent specified in regulations, taxpayers should be able to do X, Y, and Z, and in that case where the regulations must be written first. The chief counsel's office concluded this was a self-executing law, and because of that, the IRS had to pay attention to it. Now, this becomes real interesting, and as this memorandum will point out, there's been a lot of court cases about issues like this. I mentioned that about the charitable regulations earlier. My suspicion is the service is worried that at some point they would face this argument on the charitable regulations from somebody who used the 990 system. Therefore, the service is now going to try to shut that down by issuing regs, because there's a little question. Remember the ruling we had on the foreign tax, on the foreign earned income exclusion a couple of weeks ago? Remember that case where the IRS was given the authority to write regulations and they could specify terms? In this case, once the IRS specifies them, they'll lock it down. More charitable issues are arising for us in Notice 2015-62. In this particular ruling, we're going to look at foundation managers. There's an excise tax under Section 4944 that applies to Jeopardy investments, and that is if a foundation, a private foundation, makes investments that are deemed to be risky or jeopardize the foundation's charitable purpose. Generally, the manager must exercise due professional care in selecting investments. And both the foundation and the manager can be penalized if the foundation doesn't do that. There is a specific exception for what is called a program-related investment. That is an investment where the concept is we're not making an investment per se, though we may own an equity interest, but we're putting money in this primarily to advance our tax-exempt purpose. That is an exception. But here's where the question arose. What if, in fact, the manager was not actually investing in this program directly to advance the charity's purposes, so it wasn't really funding up some program via this investment, but in making its choice of investments, the foundation may take a look at one investment and decide that by putting money into this investment as opposed to putting it into some other potentially higher yielding, less risky investment, they would still be supporting their general charitable purpose. Can the foundation select that as an investment? That is, use as one of the criteria for selecting an investment whether it furthers their charitable purpose, or does the foundation have to always go and have to be able to justify every investment purely on the basis of return and risk? This particular ruling specifies directly that the foundation manager is not limited to only being concerned with return and risk. They still have to make a prudent decision, but it is perfectly acceptable for them to consider with an investment that if they make it in this particular program or this particular entity, it would advance their charitable purpose as opposed to investing in another. That can cause all kinds of interesting issues that would allow the foundation to make certain investments that maybe they have some goal to advance some program. They want to consider not investing in organizations, perhaps, that they feel go against that program, or the flip side, investing in organizations that are advancing that program. The ruling states essentially that it will not be deemed to be a Jeopardy investment merely because they didn't maximize. they can make such a determination. The ruling looks actually to state fiduciary law and the Prudent Investor Act and notes that trustees are allowed to make such considerations. Therefore, they're saying foundation managers should be allowed to make such considerations as well. Next up, notice 2015-68. In this case, the IRS has stated they're going to issue proposed regulations to simplify reporting for what is considered to be MEC, that is minimum essential coverage under the Health Care Act. Now, they really specify they're going to be issuing notices, and they say they're going to have regulations in four areas. And we have those four areas they're going to have regulations in are going to be for issues with providing where they must report coverage in catastrophic, that insurers have to report coverage in catastrophic health insurance plans that are through the exchange. They'll allow electronic delivery of statements reporting coverage under expatriate health plans unless the recipient opts out. Third, they're going to allow filers reporting insured group health plans to use truncated taxpayers' identification numbers, not the full Social Security numbers. Number four, though, is the one that's probably most of interest to most people here. This clarifies reporting on health reimbursement accounts. And one of the concerns was in the original regulations that exist, there was a concern that if you had a program, let's say you're an employer, and you're a small employer who otherwise is not going to be subject to employer-level reporting normally, except you provide that under your health program, you will reimburse an employee, let's say, for certain expenses not covered under the insurance program. Now, they have to participate in the insurance program to be part of the HRA, and the insurance program by itself provides minimum essential coverage. As the regulation had been read, many employers were concerned that that small employer would still have to issue a Form 1095 to the employees, not a 1095C as the employer, but a 1095B as effectively the insurance provider, because they were providing the plan. They were the plan provider because that was the one paying in. The insurance company's reporting wouldn't count. The IRS says we're going to propose regulations coming out here to be effective for this year that would state that if there is such an HRA where you can only participate in the HRA if you participate in the insurance program, the insurance program provides MEC, the employer will not have to report. If you have that same HRA, but you don't require participation in the insurance program, you will still have to report for people who are not covered by the insurance program, but you can leave off the people who are. The IRS had mentioned there'd be some discussions, some programs that are reported by various tax services, where they had discussed, yes, they understood this problem. They understood the complaints that this was going to be duplicative reporting. Remember, this year the IRS is going to actually start trying to enforce the rules for having to have coverage. So that's the reason why they want to have it. But the idea is if the person already has coverage for the month, the service doesn't need to know they have more coverage for the month. So that will be the background. But again, it only counts if, in fact, your coverage only covers those people and those expenses that would be covered otherwise under your plan. If there's anybody who's covered under your HRA that's not covered under the plan, that's not going to be reported by the insurance company, then you still have to report. Next up, Revenue Procedure 2015-47. This provides a hardship waiver for certain retirement plan form electronic filing requirements. It provides a waiver of electronic filing for certain retirement plan forms that are filed technically with the IRS. These forms, generally, if you file more than 250 forms with the IRS, you're required to. That's usually with W-2s and the like. Then you are, or let's say 1099s even. You're required to file all documents electronically with the IRS. That will include these 5500s. Now, of course, most 5500 forms are required to be filed with the Department of Labor via the EFAS-2 system. However, technically, there's a couple of forms that are really IRS forms. They may still be filed through EFAS-2 in some cases, but they really are IRS forms. So the IRS has provided relief from electronic filing. First, somebody who would have to file a 5500EZ, the one participant plan. Now, technically, if they need to electronically file, they've got to step up to the 5500 series forms because EFAS doesn't take these. And it's going to be unlikely many 5500EZ filers are going to be required to file electronically because, of course, you know, the 250 filing rule is not going to be 250 W-2s normally with the one participant plan, except for highly unusual situations. So it'd be somebody who, let's say, just has 250 1099s are filing. Or the form 8955 SSA, that's going to come up more often because that's when you have a participant who's separated from service that has a vested benefit that's still in your plan. If you want to file those forms on paper, you have to get the IRS's permission. The IRS warns that those who are required, and I say if you're required to file those forms on electronically, that's going to be those people that trip the 250. The IRS warns they are only going to allow the out in extremely rare cases. So don't expect you'll get it. Also, they say apply at least 45 days before the due date so that you can comply with electronic filing if the IRS says no. In essence, expect to be turned down. Finally, let's take a look at a case here. The case of Kennedy versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2015-57. This is the case of a taxpayer who voluntarily filed a Form 1040X. She received an exam notice that questioned her right to receive a refundable first-time homebuyer credit. In response to the notice for the exam, the taxpayer went ahead and prepared a 1040X, removed the refundable credit from the return, and of course showed a balance due. Now, she didn't pay the balance due, but she did file that form. The IRS, of course, now is trying to collect the tax based on that. After the collection process is running, she filed for a collection due process hearing. And instead of merely asking, could I pay this on an installment basis, now she's thinking, maybe, you know what, I shouldn't have filed that amended return, that actually the tax wasn't really due. So she wants to challenge the validity of the tax. Generally, collection due process hearings, the IRS does not, appeals does not have to listen to a challenge to validity of the tax if the taxpayer previously had a chance to raise this issue. The appellate conferee determined that because of the amended return, she had previously had a chance to challenge it. She had basically caved in and gave up on the exam. So therefore, the agent said, I'm not going to consider that. She wasn't offering any collection alternatives. So basically, they turned her down as a collection due process hearing. She filed a tax court petition. The tax court found that she had never previously had the right to challenge this, because the challenge has to be won before appeals. As the IRS had never in the exam actually proposed an assessment, issued a 30-day letter, and where she could have filed to appeals, but rather she had put the 1040X forward on her own and had basically volunteered the tax and had not agreed to anything, and the IRS assessed based on that voluntary form, the taxpayer has a right to challenge the validity of the tax, and therefore the appellate conferee basically was out of line and basically had an abuse of discretion by not allowing the taxpayer to raise the question of whether, in fact, she should have been allowed the refundable credit to begin with. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of September the 21st, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you by Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated. Be sure and join us next week as we'll go over more developments here in the area of federal taxes. Also, visit our website at www.currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, where we have links to all the details of cases we talked about this week, some more description in these cases and some more details you might want to take a look at, as well as where we're going to post developments as they occur in the coming weeks in the area of federal taxes.